You can find more Audible Anarchist on YouTube.
CKMS 102.7 FM, tu radio comunitaria.
You know, this is just one form of many ways that Israel is tightening its grip on Jerusalem and trying to change the characters of the city so that Palestinians either leave it or are rendered invisible in it.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. With me is my co-host, Asa Wynn-Stanley. Asa, how are you?
I'm great. I'm very happy to be here again, and I think we're awesome.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well. This is our third episode of the revamped Electronic Intifada podcast, and in a few minutes we'll go to an interview with our colleague, Tamara Nassar, who's going to talk about some recent brutal home evictions in occupied East Jerusalem, as well as ethnic cleansing operations against Palestinian Bedouin communities. And then she's also going to talk about these very close relationships between Israel and leaders, monarchies, dictators in some of the Gulf states, and why it's important to keep our eyes on those relationships. But first, Asa, what are you reading about, thinking about, reporting on this week?
Well, I've mostly been thinking about and reading about Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar did nothing wrong. Ilhan Omar, everything she said was factual and accurate. And if I fault her for anything, it's for apologizing. It really...
Backtrack a little bit and tell us who Ilhan Omar is, if anyone's been stuck under a rock the last week and a half and hasn't seen what's
been
taking place.
Yeah, I think we probably will do an episode about this, won't we, at some point, because it's such a big topic. But Ilhan Omar, the new congresswoman who, you know, she's on the left, and she tweeted... saying it's all about the Benjamins.
Right. This was in response to Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept talking about how the GOP leader, Kevin McCarthy, was trying to figure out a way to punish Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and also Rashida Tlaib of Michigan for being open about their support of the Palestinian-led campaign for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And Glenn Greenwald was tweeting about how it's completely absurd and how, you know, the of course he's being supported by Israel lobby interests in trying to punish these two congresswomen. And Ilhan Omar tweeted, well, it's all about the Benjamins, baby, which is a line from a late 90s hip-hop track by Puff Daddy.
Yeah, and then when she was asked who is paying people to support Israel, she said AIPAC, which is just factually true. Like, so...
Right.
There.
And who asked her? Who was that person that asked her? It was Batya Ungar Sargon, who's the opinion editor for the Forward.
Yeah, and the worst person.
Who then led... This tirade against her for using what Batya called anti-Semitic tropes, which she couldn't even really back up herself, and it kind of led to this unbelievable pile-on for several days.
Yeah, and then her newspaper then used the incident to raise Benjamins for their newspaper, sending out a fundraising email around, which is the most cynical thing, and which AIPAC also did. It caused some division, this whole thing. There was a big outcry against her, and there was, she's come under attack from Trump, the arch anti-Semite, and more disgustingly, I mean, because we would expect it from the right, but she's come under attack from Democrats, the Democratic Party establishment, and she was kind of forced, in my opinion, to issue an apology for, you know, the way she tweeted. And it, the whole thing did cause some divisions on the left, as the whole Labour anti-Semitism hoax has done in the UK.
Right. I mean, that's what was really revealing about this whole avalanche of, you know, of smear attacks against Ilhan Omar, is that it kind of read exactly from the playbook of what racists have been, and, you know, racist leaders in the UK have been doing against Corbyn, yeah, and anyone in the Labour Party who has an inkling of support for Palestinian rights.
Yeah, so the Labour anti-Semitism smear campaign is best understood as a campaign by racists to smear anti-racists as racists. And this is exactly what's happening here. Yeah. You know, you've got Donald Trump, an arch racist, yeah, calling an anti-racist, Ilhan Omar, a racist. And it's the most, right, disgusting, cynical thing. And you're right, it's exactly the same playbook as what's happened here. It's all the same dynamics and all the same mistakes are being made, where there's even people who on the left who are good intentioned, who are saying, well, you know, she was right, but she shouldn't have said it the way she said it. You know, right, they're saying, oh, well, and
yeah, God forbid she should talk about the financial aspect of what lobbies do. I mean, it was completely, it hit a level of absurdity, but it also spoke to this overwhelming pattern of attacks against Black women, Muslims, and anti-racist people who understand that Palestinians are under a violent, you know, apartheid and occupation system that is fully funded by the United States. So it kind of, you know, it was this combination of so many factors of misogyny and anti-Black, yeah, racism and Islamophobia, you know, directed at this one congresswoman for stating simple facts about a lobby group on Capitol,
yeah,
Hill.
What it's doing is actually singling out Israel for special protection. I mean, it's the only
something that they accuse everyone,
exactly,
else of doing.
It's the only lobby that you're not supposed to talk about as lobbying, as paying people off.
Right,
of course,
right,
it pays people off. Of course it does.
Yeah.
I mean, and then there was several articles afterwards which were kind of supporting her, but saying, oh, well, she was mistaken. Like, there was an article in The Guardian, pro-Israel donors spend over $22 million on lobbying and contributions in 2018. And then even the thrust of the article was like to support her central point and saying, yeah, you know, they do this. But even that article, like, kind of ticks her off. It's supporting the article, the essential basis of it. And in the article, quoting from this researcher into lobby groups, and this person is saying, I haven't observed many other countries that have a comparable level of activity, at least in domestic lobbying data. And then the journalist, this Guardian journalist, Tom Perkins, then says, Omar incorrectly suggested AIPAC makes campaign contributions to candidates. However, records show it did spend about $3.5 million lobbying during the 2018 election cycle. Well, you know, this person's there, this, right, ticking off Ilhan Omar and getting their facts wrong, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it just... It was an extreme form of gaslighting,
yeah.
And the fact that all of these, you know, liberals and, you know, soft Zionists were trying to somehow criticize Omar for saying exactly what was factually correct about Israel's lobby groups. while trying not to look as racist as they are, was just, it was messy and clunky, and it just revealed exactly what Omar was pointing out, that there is massive influence, inside the halls of power, and by Israel lobby organizations, and AIPAC being an umbrella organization for many lobby groups.
Somehow
we weren't supposed to talk about that.
And some of it even comes from some leftists, which is really infuriating, where they get into this thing where they say, oh, well, actually, I agree with Noam Chomsky, and I think it's down to ideology and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. And it's just really stupid, because AIPAC does buy off candidates. It uses dark money to do it. You know, they say, oh, well, I looked on I had some idiot, like, with some sort of Marxist Twitter handle, you know, claiming to be a Marxist. But like, they're just ignoring, it's some kind of, you know, it's not a very good Marxist who ignores like objective facts, the objective reality of AIPAC literally buying off people, buying off candidates with dark money. And the, you know, in the Israel lobby documentary, they explained in their own words how they did that, you know.
Right. Right. You know?
They use this kind of off the books money, and they skirt around electoral law, but they definitely do it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of absurd to think, you know, the AIPAC, which raises, I don't know, tens of millions of dollars a year. What are they spending it on, birthday parties for their, you know, for their workers? It's completely absurd. But you know what I thought was also really important to point out was that after 3 or 4 days of being completely bullied and smeared as an anti-Semite and all of this absurd attacks against her, Ilhan Omar then, led, I think, one of the most, anti-war interrogations of one of the most notorious pro-genocide architects of destabilization
Elliot Abrams campaigns. So damn good.
It was amazing. You know, and she, it wasn't even like, you know, very radical questioning. No. She was just like, okay, you lied to Congress in 1991 about your involvement in supplying arms to the Contras. What makes you think that we can trust you now in your efforts at regime change in Venezuela? And I think that was, you know, just that level of, again, laying out the facts and not being apologetic and not compromising in her leadership as an elected lawmaker. That's what we expect our electeds to do.
I love how she just refused to accept this whole idea of, oh, we've got to be civil, you know.
That's right. That's right. And she, I mean, she was dignified. She had integrity. She didn't let Abrams, you know, complete meltdown and hysteria, waver her at all. I mean, this was probably the first time in his life that he had ever been made uncomfortable.
Or even questioned, you know.
Even questioned
on something actually matters, as opposed to like, oh, yeah, you know, you lied to someone who is important. You know what I mean?
Right. And as I pointed out in a blog post that I posted on EI last week, you know, her commitment to anti-racist principles that were exemplified in her interrogation of Elliot Abrams is something that I think the Democrats fear as much as they feared her speaking openly about AIPAC and the Israel lobby influence. Yeah. You know, they don't, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the top Democratic Party leadership, they are gunning for regime change in Venezuela. And when they see, you know, this hotshot, you know, congresswoman, speaking her truth and taking these centers of power into account, holding their feet to the fire, that I think made them nervous, to say.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think this goes to the heart of the threat from the left, as they would see it, because what this represents, what Ilhan Omar represents that's new, is an actual challenge on foreign policy. Bernie Sanders has given them a challenge on domestic policy in terms of having some sort of, you know, basic just, I don't know, not like
common sense.
Just like yeah. having some sort of healthcare or anything. Just
right.
Common, yeah, just common sense stuff, basically, that you would need in any kind of sort of social democratic government and state. But, you know, he's often, from our point of view, been incredibly lacking on questions of international solidarity. And even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we can say the same about her. But what Ilhan Omar represents is a challenge to that, you know, and not just on Palestine, but the fact that Palestine is this emblematic issue, and the fact that she for international solidarity, and the fact that she's challenging Elliot Abrams, the architect of these American imperial dirty wars in Latin America, is just, it is really incredibly inspiring. So. Right. Listeners, everyone, go and read Nora's piece about this. Ilhan Omar takes on the establishment, and, you know, ignore anything else that's out there. Don't read anything else. Don't read things.
Read her transcript of her grilling.
Yeah,
Elliot
Abrams. It's so good.
It's pretty remarkable.
Watch it.
The video's even better. But yeah,
you can go to Nora's article on electronicintifada.net, Ilhan Omar takes on the establishment, and it's the video's there, and Nora also did an article for In These Times, which was also very good. So
Thanks. I was very fired up about it last week. As I think most leftists, you know, real hardcore anti-racist leftists should have been.
Yeah, I think it was
inspiring,
full stop, to see something like that happen, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick music break. We'll be back with Tamara in 1 minute. Stay tuned. Joining us on the Electronic Intifada podcast is our colleague, Tamara Nassar. Tamara, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Nora and Issa. Glad to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So we wanted to get a sense of what you've been focusing on recently through your work at the Electronic Intifada. Take us through a little bit about what you cover and the stories that you've been... you've been reporting on lately and why they're important.
Absolutely. So in the past, I would say year or so, I have been focusing on Gulf states' growing normalization with Israel. This has largely been a covert effort, but is coming out of the shadows now with a mutual enmity towards Iran at the core of it. So that's really been my focus. Of course, in many of those Gulf states, the public is actually very opposed to normalization with Israel. So there's also been, I've been covering incidents where sport athletes or artists and other people from those countries who refuse to participate in tournaments or championships because there is Israeli participation. So that's my main focus, but I also write a lot about prisoners' affairs, Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, as well as Israeli demolitions and property seizures of Palestinians that occur within the occupied West Bank and the occupied Golan Heights, but also sometimes inside of Israel.
So, speaking of which, you just published a story over the last few days about this just heinous, horrifying expulsion of a Palestinian family from their home that they've had for nearly 70 years in occupied East Jerusalem's Old City. Can you talk a little bit about this story, about this family, the Abu Asab family, and what happened to them over the weekend?
Absolutely. So Israeli occupation forces arrived to the Abu Asab family home in the Muslim quarter of occupied East Jerusalem on Sunday and forcibly evicted them from their homes and handed their homes over to Jewish settlers. So the Abu Asab family is originally from the Baqa neighborhood, which is located in western Jerusalem, where tens of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly expelled during the Nakba, which is the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians carried out by Zionist paramilitary forces in 1948. So this is not the first time that the Abu Asab family are rendered refugees in their own city. They moved to this home that they were just expelled from in 1952. When they were expelled from their original home in 1948, they first moved to Damascus Gate in the old city, and then they moved to this home, which is originally owned by the Nusaybe family. It's a Palestinian family from Jerusalem called the Nusaybe family, who had leased the property to Jewish settlers, to the Jewish residents before 1948, and this lease was for 99 years. And despite the fact that the lease has ended, the family handed the property over to a trust, and then the trust was taken over by settlers who launched a legal effort against the Abu Asab family in 2014 to seize the home that they were living in, despite the fact that they were paying rent consistently to the absentee property guard. So under Israeli law, under the 1950 absentee property law, Israel has the right to keep Palestinian homes that Palestinians left or were forcibly expelled from in 1948, and would not allow Palestinians to reclaim their homes or even receive compensation for these homes. But a 1970 amendment to this law allows Jewish residents to reclaim property that they left in 1948. So this is a blatantly racist measure against Palestinians. And the Abu Asab family now cannot, for example, return to the home that they were forcibly expelled from in the Baqa neighborhood where they're originally from. But the Jewish settlers who now live in their home that they were just expelled from a few days ago is not even the same Jewish family that lived there before 1948. So this is a blatantly racist measure, and Palestinians, especially in occupied East Jerusalem, are constantly subjected to that kind of fear of being on the verge of imminent eviction, even after being in that home for about seven decades.
I think this is a good example of Israeli settlers essentially and what they do, and why the issue of Israeli settlements is not some sort of theoretical thing. It's part of, like, when we say the Israeli colonization of Palestinian land, and it's talked about by Palestine solidarity campaigners in that way, it's not like a theoretical thing or a historical thing. It's something that's very actively going on, and it's something sort of these kind of evictions really sort of illustrate the brutality of Israeli colonialism and Israeli settlements. So how common is this sort of, this kind of story is something that you cover a fair bit. So, like, how common is it for this kind of thing to happen in the West Bank and Jerusalem?
I would say it's pretty common. I mean, there's another family that's facing a similar legal battle right now. Actually, it's they're facing imminent eviction. The Israeli High Court ruled for their imminent eviction by January 23rd, so they could be evicted any day now. It's the Sabagh family. They live in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. It's a family of 40, 30 of which are children. And if they are evicted, these people have nowhere to go. They are originally from Yaffa, and they own two homes there. And following the Nakba, they moved to Sheikh Jarrah in 1956, and Israel took over their homes in Yaffa. So now if the Sabagh family is actually evicted from their homes, from their home in Sheikh Jarrah, they cannot return to Yaffa, of course, and they will just be rendered homeless. So there was a quote by Muhammad Sabagh, who is one of the older members of the family, who said, why can't I take my property back from 1948? The same way, you know, Israel wants to seize this property in the name of, you know, this, that it belongs to Jewish residents before 1948. So I would say it's pretty common, especially in occupied East Jerusalem, where Israel is further entrenching its occupation through either literally forcibly evicting Palestinians from their homes pumping money into settlement projects, and there was a recent report in Israel Yahom about an Israeli government agency called the Company for the Reconstruction and Development of the Jewish Quarter, which is a company wholly owned and established by the Israeli government, and they just allocated $55 million for projects in Jerusalem. Of course, these projects are being done in the name of tourism and developing tourist routes and all of that. But Israeli human rights group Ir Amim says that Israel uses this excuse of exploiting tourism as a tool for reinforcing settlement initiatives in Jerusalem and basically trying to erase Palestinian presence from the city by tightening its grip on it. So, you know, this is just one form of many ways that Israel is tightening its grip on Jerusalem and trying to change the characters of the city so that Palestinians either leave it or are rendered invisible in it. After the eviction of the Palestinian Abu Asab family on Sunday, Israeli forces closed the doors of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and closed and placed locks on the Bab al-Rahma site where Palestinians pray. And I mean, it's collective punishment.
I think that it's the way that Israel entrenches its occupation is multifaceted. And I suppose reading your latest article about this, which we'll link to when we post this podcast, your article is titled "Settler Soldiers Seize Jerusalem Home from Palestinian Family." And it's completely common, I suppose, to answer my own question to you. And as you said, it's a very common thing to happen for Palestinians to be expelled in this way. And I suppose in your article, the only thing that struck me as unusual was that they would even have any kind of connection. The Jewish settlers would have any kind of connection to the Palestinian home. That's the unusual aspect of it, because, you know, as you've alluded to in talking about the Israeli laws, the racist Israeli laws, any Jewish person from around the world, whether or not they have any kind of connection to Palestine, has more of a right to, under Israeli law, to settle in Palestinian homes than Palestinians themselves. Can you talk a little bit about Israeli settlements and how Israeli law kind of discriminates against Palestinians in that way?
Yeah, I mean, Israeli settlements are some of the most, or house some of the most racist Israelis in the Palestinian Mandate. So it's you're absolutely right that most of the time when these kinds of things occur, settlers are firmly protected by Israeli soldiers. So this Israeli family who just moved into the Abu Asab family home walked into the house right in front of them, and they, while Israeli soldiers were beating Hatem Abu Asab and arresting him along with his son and beating one of the aunts of the family. So it's like you said, any Jewish person from anywhere in the world has more claim over Palestinian land and property than Palestinians who have been living there for decades. And this Jewish family that's just moved into the Abu Asab family home, not only do they have no connection to to the family home. Let's say for a second that it was actually the Jewish family that lived there before 1948. They were not even the owners of this house. The actual owners of this house are the Nusseibeh family, who were leasing the home for the Jewish family that was living there before 1948 and fled after the Nakba. So it's this family is originally owned by Palestinians as well. So but Israeli law still allows the High Court to hand over one Palestinian home to another Jewish family without any problem or legal battle under Israeli law.
And you look at the video, and we'll link, of course, to some of the videos that you embedded in your report on this, Tamara. But I mean, it's not just like a couple of police officers, protecting this, the settler family, and easing their casual transition into this Palestinian family's home. This is like a highly militarized. I mean, there were like dozens of Israeli police, some of whom you mentioned, were beating some of the members of the Palestinian family, and preventing the family and people in the community from protecting the family from being evicted as their home was being seized by these settlers. And this isn't just like, as you were mentioning, this isn't just a one-off thing. This isn't just an anomaly situation. This is happening all the time, not just in East Jerusalem, but elsewhere in the West Bank. And as well, in places inside Israel itself, you've also been documenting the forced expulsion of Palestinian Bedouin in the Nakab, in the Negev Desert, as well as other communities inside the Jordan Valley. Can you talk a little bit about those stories as well, and how these home evictions that we're seeing in broad daylight in Jerusalem are connected to what's happening inside the Nakab and in other Palestinian communities around historic Palestine?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd like to also talk about the community, the Palestinian village of Khan al-Ahmar, which has been facing imminent demolition for years now. So Khan al-Ahmar is a small Palestinian village located in Area C of the occupied West Bank, which constitutes 60% of the occupied West Bank. And it's a community of about 200 Bedouins who come from the Jahalin tribe. And Khan al-Ahmar has been facing imminent demolition and forcible evacuation by Israel for the past several years, and the Israeli High Court in the past few months completely approved their imminent demolition, and this community could be forcibly displaced and evacuated, and their whole village demolished any time now. And even though there has been several delays in their demolition, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is constantly reaffirming that Khan al-Ahmar will be evacuated, and that it's a court ruling, and that this is Israeli policy, and that it will be done. The location of Khan al-Ahmar is very important because it lies in the E1 area, which is this area east of Jerusalem, that basically separates the northern and southern West Bank from each other. And Khan al-Ahmar is kind of this last hope. And if Khan al-Ahmar is evacuated, any kind of fantasy of a two-state solution would be over, because this is where Israel is planning to expand its mega settlements of Ma'ale Adumim and Kfar Adumim. So Khan al-Ahmar has been subject to harassment by settlers over the course of this legal battle. Activists and journalists have been trying to sleep there sometimes to try to protect it. And I mean, eventually Israel wants to force Khan al-Ahmar's residents to move to an area called Al-Jabal West, which is located near a landfill of the Palestinian village of Abu Dis. And this is, of course, this would absolutely not work with the lifestyle of these villagers, who live a nomadic lifestyle and need to live in an area that is not the landfill.
Something that I find quite interesting and that I've noticed in about Khan al Ahmar is that because I cover the Israel lobby in the UK, you notice that even some of the people who are quite, like politicians who are quite actually pro-Israel on balance, and you know, who do things like claim that the Labour Party is an anti-Semitic party and whatnot. There's one particularly nasty MP called Wes Streeting. Even some of them have been critical of the Israeli government for its treatment of Khan al-Ahmar because it's such an obvious act of racist ethnic cleansing. But I mean, as you started to talk about, there's really no difference to how Israel treats Palestinians, or there's mm-hmm. there's little difference anyway to how Israel treats Palestinians all over historic Palestine. So can you talk a bit about how Israel is also ethnically cleansing Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Nakab? And maybe talk a little bit about like the similarities and differences, if there are some, with Israeli ethnic cleansing in the West Bank.
Definitely. There's an area in the Nakab called Imm al-Hiran, where Israel has been trying to... that Israel has been trying to forcibly expel and demolish also for a long time. The Israeli government in April of last year tried to force residents to agree to their own expulsion. They want to resettle them in a town in the southern Naqab called Houra under threats of violence. So, I mean, there is definitely a connection. It all goes back to the root blatant racism of not wanting Palestinians to be in areas, especially ripe areas where Israel plans to expand its settlements make life so difficult for Palestinians that they either leave themselves or they are forcibly expelled. And Umm al-Hiran is a village of 350 people, and they're all citizens of Israel. And if the expulsion is carried out, all of them would be rendered homeless. What you said about the unusual condemnation that Khan al-Ahmar receives, or the unusual condemnation from European Union and UK leaders who criticize Israel's measures in Khan al-Ahmar. There's of course like a lot of verbal opposition, but apart from verbal opposition, EU states have failed to spell out any clear consequences for Israel if it defies these calls.
Yeah, so I think that's a really important point to make, actually. Yeah, that definitely goes for the people I was talking about. Absolutely, it's lip service, isn't it?
Same for politicians in the U.S. I believe Dianne Feinstein, one of my senators here in California, who has been a staunch advocate of Israeli policy, issued some kind of, mealy-mouthed condemnation of Israel's plans to ethnically cleanse Khan al-Ahmar. But of course, as you said, there is like no mention of consequence. And of course, Dianne Feinstein will be one of the first, Democratic senators to re-sign another military aid package to Israel, the first chance.
Yeah, and
she
gets. It's also usually couched in terms of like criticizing Netanyahu rather than, the pointing out the fact
Absolutely.
That this is sort of this goes through what Israel is, like as and what Zionism is, like, because you can't possibly criticize that.
Definitely. They paint it as a character of the current Israeli government, and that, once Netanyahu is replaced, everything will be resolved, as opposed to, this is actually like an essential part of the essential essence of how Israel came to be. And I mean, this is very common with the EU, and I can talk about this forever, but the EU funds so many construction projects for Palestinians in Area C, which is, the most contested area in the occupied West Bank. And even though Israel caused an estimated $74 million in destruction for EU-funded projects from 2001 until 2016. And the EU has done absolutely nothing to hold Israel accountable for destroying these projects. That's $74 million in projects that Israel destroyed. And the European Union continues to, you know, condemn Israel's actions and condemn Israel's demolitions and sometimes even send delegations to visit Khan al-Ahmar and to visit those areas. But at the end of the day, they keep building and Israel keeps destroying and the relationship is as strong as ever.
We're speaking with Tamara Nassar, our colleague at the Electronic Intifada, speaking about home demolitions, the brutal continuing policies of ethnic cleansing by Israel against Palestinians. Tamara, as you mentioned at the beginning, you're also covering a lot of the power dynamics and the close relationship building between Israeli leaders and leaders of Gulf states. Walk us through a little bit about your most recent reporting on this, and you know, tell us why it's important to factor in these kinds of relationships between leaders in the Gulf and Israel, and why and how it kind of fits into this context of building Israel's projects of Zionism and violence in the region.
Yes, there's definitely been a huge rise in normalization between Arab countries, especially in the Gulf, and with Israel. This, I suppose, the most recent blatant form of it was when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went to Oman to visit to meet with Sultan Qaboos. Oman and Israel have no formal diplomatic relations. In fact, Israel has no formal diplomatic relations with any of these Gulf states.
So this is, for listeners, this is Oman, the country, not Amman, the city. This is the country next to Yemen.
Yes. Jordan and Israel do have diplomatic relations. But, so when Netanyahu visited Oman, this was the most, you know, blatant form of overt normalization with a country with no formal diplomatic relations. We saw last week in the Warsaw conference, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also met with the Omani foreign minister, Yusuf bin Alawi. The meeting was supposed to be in secret. Yusuf bin Alawi actually arrived to Netanyahu's hotel in the Polish capital from like the side door, but Israeli journalist Barak Ravid caught him on camera sneaking into the building, and then the official meeting between Netanyahu and bin Alawi was actually videotaped, and in the video you know, Netanyahu thanks bin Alawi for meeting with him again. And he says that he feels at liberty to speak on behalf of not only Israelis, but many people in the Middle East to thank Oman for their warming up to Israel. But this also has been it's very disgusting, but it's also been happening with other Gulf states. Of course, this is being pushed by Saudi Arabia with the mutual enmity towards Iran at the core. In October, while there was a blitz of normalization with Israel, there was an Israeli judo team that went to the UAE to participate under the promise by the Emirates that they would allow the Israeli flag to be displayed and the Israeli anthem to be played should the Israeli team win any medals, which they did, and the Israeli anthem was played in Abu Dhabi. And racist Israeli cultural minister Miri Regev was there, and she even cried while the Hatikva was playing in Abu Dhabi. Same thing in Qatar. The Israeli gymnastics team went to Qatar and participated in a tournament there. And these are just, you know, sparse events that show just a larger effort by these Gulf states to basically race to Israel's heart out of mutual animosity and warmongering against Iran. Mm-hmm. So Yeah.
And this is the same Miri Regev who once apologized to cancer sufferers for comparing them to black people.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, could you talk a little bit about normalization and the concept of normalization in Arab countries? Because many listeners may not be familiar with this, and maybe talk a little bit about how Israel is regarded in that way by people in the Gulf state, as opposed to, well, in the Arab world in general, as opposed to the sort of the Arab dictators and other leaders.
Definitely. I mean, there was a moment in the Warsaw Conference. The Yemeni foreign minister was seated right next to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's microphone malfunctioned, the Yemeni foreign minister lended him his microphone, and former settler guard Jason Greenblatt went to Twitter and of course celebrated this moment and said, you know, this is great, because when that happened, Netanyahu said, oh, this is like cooperation between Yemen and Israel. So Netanyahu is clearly exploiting like every single anything that these Gulf leaders are giving him to kind of normalize relations. But on Sunday, which this was amazing, a lot of people in Yemen were posting pictures of enormous crowds of Yemenis going out into the streets and saying, we refuse Yemeni normalization with Israel, we refuse any Arab normalization with Israel, and we do not agree to this. So the public in most of these countries are completely opposed, not only to, you know, diplomatic relations with Israel, but in many cases, and even acknowledging that Israel as a country in the region, as long as Palestinians are oppressed. Mm. So the fact that a lot of these leaders are speaking to Netanyahu and other Israeli officials, whether in secret or not, really angers the public, because it's coming at the expense of Palestinians, and most of them know it. So,
Israel has peace agreements with the Egyptian dictator and with the Jordanian king. But aside from that, Israel has no diplomatic relations with, no formal diplomatic relations with any Arab country. I think that's right. Am I right? I'm not forgetting anyone there.
No, you're right.
And can you talk a little bit about, but despite that, there are, as you alluded to earlier, there has been for many years secretive contacts between Israel and Gulf dictators in particular. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that?
Definitely. I mean, Barak Ravid, who I mentioned earlier, Israeli journalist with Israel's Channel 10 and 13, has been documenting that history recently in a series of normalization in history pieces. And most of these relationships span two decades or more, which is really crazy. And I mean, this has been, I've been covering events of, you know, secret meetings between Israeli officials in those Gulf states or with Gulf leaders. One of the recent events of an Israeli leader visiting one of those Gulf states was Israeli opposition leader Avi Gabay, who visited the UAE in December and met with senior Israeli officials. There's also been, I mean, Qatar, which is a very, people seem to think that it's actually one of the biggest normalizers with Israel. Ali Abu Na'ma and I wrote a report in the summer about how Qatar funded the Zionist Organization of America. And
yeah,
other...
I find this quite staggering, really. I mean, I I would have thought the Qataris would have been smart enough, like from their point of view, to have funded, I don't know, like J Street or something, and then they could have at least said, oh, you know, these are, you know, liberal and pro-peace or whatever, or whatever kind of propaganda like that. But instead they chose the Zionist Organization of America, the most, you know, right-wing...
Extremist,
Zionist organization, Mort Klein, openly racist, you know. I mean, like, why? what do you make of that? I mean, I still don't quite get that.
Yeah, I mean, ever since Qatar faced the regional isolation and blockade by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, it has really tried to escape that by running to Washington's heart, and the closest route to Washington's heart is through Israel. So leading up to that event, Qatar was inviting so many Zionist figures, Zionist American figures, to Qatar to go on these state-sponsored trips where they would meet with Qatari officials and go on these tours. And I mean, some of the influential figures that they invited included the Zionist Organization of America's president, Morton Klein, as well as Zionist propagandist lunatic Alan Dershowitz, who visited Qatar twice that we know of, including a trip.
I think we could say now as well, alleged pedophile Alan Dershowitz.
Yes. One of the worst people on the planet. Yeah. and he visited Qatar twice, including one trip where he went to Northwestern University in Qatar, and he gave a lecture, and students actually walked out from the lecture and filmed themselves walking out of the lecture in protest of his presence in Qatar. And, you know, after the first time, he came back to the U.S. and published an article in The Hill singing of Qatar's praises and saying, you know, why is Saudi Arabia blockading Qatar? And Qatar is the Israel of the Middle East. That's one of the lines from his piece. And
yeah. No way.
Yeah. I mean, Qatar's ruler, Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, has been absolutely shameless in his all-out giving literal funds to the Zionist Organization of America and this other organization called Our Soldiers Speak, which gets Israeli soldiers to go on speaking tours in the U.S. to spread their propaganda. So,
I think it's... I'm kind of speechless.
Yeah, I mean, those trips also included Mike Huckabee and the conservative radio host John Batchelor, and a lot of them came back. I mean, Mike Huckabee tweeted about his trip and tweeted some pictures and said that Qatar was a beautiful country. John Batchelor.
I think we could say that these people were bought off with Qatari lobby money, you know. In the same way that many American politicians are bought off with Israeli lobby money, we're not going to be called Islamophobic for saying that.
No, the Qatari government literally gave $1.45 million for Lexington Strategies, which is the firm that was lobbying on its behalf in the U.S. So, and this was all disclosed in a FARA. In a FARA document, so it's not making this up.
Tamara, before we close out, what are some stories that you're currently watching right now, and what's coming up for you on the Electronic Intifada?
Well, I'm honestly closely watching Barak Ravid's reports. They contain a lot of staggering information about normalization that happened in the past years that was mostly either not confirmed or not covered before. One detail that really shocked me was that, well, it's hard to say that I was shocked, but that really, it's always sickening, it's rarely shocking, was that the Saudi government supported Israel during its assault, during its war on Lebanon in 2006, and urged them to strike Hezbollah with all their might, and were actually disappointed with Israel's with the results of the war, the report also revealed that former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met with a Saudi prince in Amman with King Abdullah. So these kinds of meetings have been happening. That was in 2006, right after the Israel's war in Lebanon. So these details are very important to understand, because there is so much that happens that is completely covert and that is not really not information that anyone knows about, and it tells a lot about how Israel thinks of its foreign policy to people, you know, in the region, which is why Israel's whole like shtick with being surrounded by enemies just always baffles me, because you know all these people are more of your friends than right. they're ever going to protect the Palestinians.
Yeah,
you actually have many many friends in the region.
I think that when they're talking about being surrounded by enemies, what they actually mean is the people, the Arab people themselves, because it's quite telling that they have to make peace agreements with dictatorships, essentially. And I think that and it just shows like the what you were talking about, how Israel is not accepted by people in the region because of the way it was founded and the war crimes that were necessary to found Israel. And I think that what the point you made about the Saudis supporting Israeli war crimes in Lebanon in 2006 is illustrative of how Israel and Gulf dictatorships, Arab dictatorships, are like actually natural partners. Like the Saudis are like the Saudi monarchs are, you know, they're similarly sectarian, racist, anti-democratic forces, which are meddling. Both countries are meddling in other countries around the world. You know, so those regimes deserve each other.
They do, and and that's why they're trying to rush out of the whole Palestinian the resolution of the Palestinian question, because what's really at the heart of all of these normalization, all of these moves towards normalization are this mutual interest in war against Iran. So, and one of the biggest obstacles that these regimes are facing are their own people, because their own people are not on the side of this kind of normalization. They care about Palestinian rights. They care about the occupation. They want an end to Israel's apartheid. They want Palestinians to get their rights of return and to be able to return to their homes, and for the occupation to be lifted, and for everyone to get equal rights in Israel. But I believe personally that before that happens, it's going to be very hard to create a boogeyman out of Iran for the general Arab public, as much as because Israel has made an enemy of itself for these people for decades.
And in fact, when he was in Warsaw last week, there was a direct translation of a comment that he made that said, "From here, I'm going to a meeting with 60 foreign ministers and envoys of countries from around the world against Iran. What is important about this meeting, and it is not in secret because there are many of those, is that this is an open meeting with representatives of leading Arab countries that are sitting down together with Israel in order to advance the common interest of combating Iran." Could also be translated to war with Iran. And apparently those comments, you know, that people said, oh, it's taken out of context. Was it really? I mean, that was the actual translation of what he said.
Yeah, I think his office was trying to save him from his own comments and said that it was mistranslated from Hebrew. And what he was actually trying to say, that you know he was calling on everyone to combat Iranian influence, but really it's just like a Freudian slip, and this is what they're going for. So it's terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, thank you, Tamara Nassar, for being with us on episode 3 of the new revamped Electronic Intifada podcast. And we're going to link to all the stories we've been talking about on the blog post that accompanies this podcast, of course. Thank you for all of